Hey, you know me. I'm Elvis Mitchell. We do the treatment here. You're about to listen to it in about 10 seconds from now. While you're sitting there patiently playing with your smartphone, diverting money to Switzerland or something, I have an idea. Help us pay for this show. We get people that only want to come to KCRW because they're attracted to what we have to offer to you. So show your attraction to them by giving us a few bucks. In fact, send us 10 bucks. Text KCRW to the number 20222. That was simple, right? You feel better? I feel better? Let's go. It's the treatment in 5, 4, 3.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is the treatment.
Shake it, don't break it. Welcome to the treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You may know the director Malcolm D. Lee for Roscoe Jenkins or Undercover Brother, or you probably know him best for a film that came out now 14 years ago, a film called The Best Man. It stars Taye Diggs, Morris Chestnut, Terrence Howard, Nia Long, Sanaa Lathan, Monica Calhoun, Melissa D'Souza, Harold Perrineau. The sequel, The Best Man Holiday, is now with us. It's writer-director Malcolm Lee sitting across from me. Malcolm, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
When I first met you, which is like about 10 years ago now, I said to you, so when is The Best Man sequel?
You did indeed.
And you had the idea for it. Even then, you knew you wanted to do it.
Yeah, you know, with the first movie, everyone was saying, not everyone, but a lot of people were fans of that one. And they said, you know, why do a sequel, do a sequel. But, you know, it was my first movie. I didn't want to repeat myself, be pigeonholed as a storyteller. So, yeah, but I said I would revisit these characters 10 years later. And, you know, it just happened it was 14 years later, so.
First of all, for the audience, tell them what the sequel is about.
Well, The Best Man Holiday is about a group of friends who from the first Best Man, college friends who.
And you reunite
the entire cast, plus a couple of newcomers, for a holiday weekend at Christmas time. At Lance and Mia's house, played by Morris Chestnut and Monica Calhoun. They're like the couple that got married in the first movie. And there's still some lingering tensions that exist, you know, between Harper and Lance, played by Taye Diggs, between Robin and Jordan, that's to Sanaa Lathan and Nia Long's character. And there's things that pop up from the past that come to manifest themselves in this one. And the main through line is that Harper, played by Taye Diggs, is trying to ghostwrite a biography for Lance Sullivan. He's kind of going through some hard times. Harper, that is, going through some.
And the fact that he, his first book, which became a bestseller, and he's been doing better financially than he is right now. His wife is about to give birth.
Exactly. And they've been having some fertility issues. And you know, now he's, kind of desperate, in a desperate situation where he's, you know, kind of low on his money. He has writer's block, some creative issues. And
I want to ask you about that, too, because that's interesting to take. Usually the writer character in these things is the one who ends up being the success.
Mm.
So to have that character be the one who's, I mean, we would have thought, looking back, if you were to project ahead, that the guy who'd be doing the worst might be Quentin, who didn't really seem to have, he seemed to be directionless, to be rudderless, or even Harold Perrineau's character, who didn't seem to be tethered to anything and didn't seem to have any real ambition himself. So talk about choosing the character who usually is the guy who is the font of wisdom, who carries the audience along and sort of is the audience surrogate. Talk about making Harper the guy who was down on his luck.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, when I first wrote the first draft of it, it was much more of an ensemble, but the studio had me focus it more. And I still had Harper having those struggles. And I wanted to, you know, flip things a little bit, you know. Harper was on the rise in the first one, and he was on the verge of great success. Even though he had made some mistakes in the past, you know, it was going to come to manifest itself, you know, in a good way, you know, for him, you know, in the first movie. With this movie, I wanted to, you know, knock him down a peg, you know, and reflect, you know, some of the economic hardships that people have been going through over the past, you know, 4 years or so. He is in a spot right now where he's struggling and trying to find answers. And that includes struggling with faith. You know, he was kind of a faithless man in the first movie, but he saw how God and faith can play a role in one's life. And now he's struggling with that even in the very beginning of the movie. And it may surprise the people, like, to find him actually praying in the beginning, looking for answers. And, you know, and I don't think it was even, you know, so much calculated on my part, but it just felt like I wanted to get the people involved with the characters. Because, you know, it was fun. And here part of the hesitation from the studio, because the tone is a little bit different than the first one.
It's a lot different. I mean, you would say a comedy with dramatic overtones. I would say that turn of phrase really applies to The Best Man Holiday.
Without question. Without question. Yeah. And we have, I think, a pretty healthy balance of comedy and drama in the movie. It doesn't ever get too heavy. It gets a little heavy for sure. And, you know, I wanted to play with those things. And what I told the studio was when they were saying the tone is so different, I said, and they said, well, our audience is going to be turned off. I said, well, I don't think so, because it's about the characters. It's about how it's about how invested and how close audiences feel to these characters in this movie, which they haven't had before 1999 in the first Best Man, and really feel a kinship to now. I mean, all these years later.
Well, it's interesting because I think when people talk about Tyler Perry, what you did first was use comedy as a way of dealing with perceptions of the black middle class, which I thought made you unique in that usually people were making fun of it. You were using comedy, you weren't making fun of your characters at all. That I thought there was a difference between what you do as a writer-director and the other comedies that are around. Would you agree?
I suppose. You know, I don't think I've...
You were shaking your head yes until I asked you. Supposing.
You know what? You know what it is? It's interesting. It's interesting that you put it that way, because I guess I hadn't thought about it that way. But what I do say, or what I do think, is that, you know, I'm taking characters that I know intimately, that people that who I am and who the people that I went to school with, you know, and I'm laughing with the characters. You know what I'm saying? You know, I think in back in the day before Best Man, there were a few flashes of it. You know, you saw it in The Cosby Show. You know, just regular people. But in comedies, anybody who was educated was somehow stiff.
And were made fun of.
Made fun of. You know, they were trying to be white, quote unquote. And they had somehow traded in their black card. You know, they needed a drop squad. You know what I mean? And, my reality.
Yeah, no. In fact, the people making movies like Drop Squad were people who had gone to college. So it seemed kind of, how best to put this, hypocritical for them to make fun of people who are educated. And that's and I think that's one of the differences, too. In certainly we can look at Best Man and then the sequel, that you don't use archetypes.
No, I mean, who wants to see that? I think there, you know, in Undercover Brother, we did that. You know, you deal with archetypes. But
that's satire.
Exactly. But you know, when you're dealing with real people or real characters, what my goal was to make three-dimensional characters or multidimensional characters.
Well, first of all, you're talking about this. You start off with basically a comedy that's basically the black version of The Big Chill.
That was certainly my intent. That was The Big Chill was a big part of the influence of The Best Man, the first Best Man, as was Four Weddings and a Funeral, The Diner, reunion movies, and you know, wedding movies, to put them all in one thing. And the truth of the matter is, I never thought of The Best Man as a comedy. I always thought of it as a drama with comedic moments. I remember when the studio would say to me, "Oh, you know, this is a comedy. I said, "No, it's a drama. It has some funny stuff in it." And that was my approach with that movie. And even like when I remember they were trying to get me to cast a comedian in the role of Quentin.
In the Terrence Howard role.
And I just said, I don't think so. Maybe, but, you know, I want to try to get actors. And that's what we had in that movie. When I saw the movies in the 90s, there were a few that spoke to me. Love Jones, Soul Food. Then there was Waiting to Exhale, and I thought, the men in that movie are very archetypal. And I want to do kind of an answer to that and make four black men who are very kind of full characters, very different guys.
And initially, if we look at them, they almost are like archetypes until we get to know them.
That's correct. That is correct. You know, the brooding intellectual, you know, the simmering athlete, the Lothario, and kind of like the nerdy, you know, do-gooder. But yes, they all have layers to them, you know, and they all can be friends, you know, ironically, and still have some common ground, but have differences, and they can debate things.
And it's got to be fascinating to you as a filmmaker and as an African-American audience member, how that now seems like the distant past, that period where movies that featuring the black middle class have almost completely disappeared.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. They do manifest itself in some movies, you know. I don't know that it's disappeared. I mean, it's just done in a different way.
No. I will argue this. That basically, a smart movie about smart black people, those have mostly gone away.
Well, I don't know.
Busted.
Have they gone away?
You tell me the examples.
I tell you what.
By the way, my guess is Malcolm D. Lee, who's about to tell me what. His new film as writer-director is The Best Man Holiday. Tell me what.
You know, I think there have been some movies that have, you know, tried to, you know, give smart black characters. They don't. Sometimes people connect to them. Sometimes they don't. I see it. Now, I remember when people were asking me, bring back The Best Man. We don't have these movies anymore. I said, well, Tyler Perry does these movies. You know, and I'm just saying, like, you know, about love stories and things like that. You know,
his movies are for the most part about working class people, and the middle class protagonist is that thing you're talking about—the person who's forgotten what he or she is. Anybody who wears has a briefcase in a Tyler Perry movie is about to learn a lesson about being black.
Well, anyway, let's jump off the Tyler Perry thing.
But my point is that, and I can tell you this, especially there are kids now in their late teens and early 20s who have grown up seeing The Best Man on television,
right,
and wonder where that kind of movie disappeared, dude.
You know, I'm happy to have brought it back, you know, if indeed that is the case, that there's, you know, a dearth of middle-class African-Americans who are educated and, by God, articulate, you know, on screen. And so, you know, I think that there's been, you know, a hunger to see these characters again. And I was happy to bring them back.
I have to think one of the things, too, and I know you for a bit, and I haven't had a chance to bring this up to you yet, was you must have been tickled by the idea of making a black holiday movie, a movie about black Christmas. Because that, in a way, is creating something that becomes a kind of classic, isn't it? That gets repeated from year to year.
Well, that was certainly in my producer head, you know, for sure. I was definitely thinking, you know, this could be a movie that gets played every year. And, you know, hopefully the soundtrack does as well. And certainly with the first Best Man, the goal of mine was to make a classic, was to make a movie that, A, stood on its own and stood the test of time. And thankfully, it's been regarded in that way. And so,
is that why you said it at a wedding? Because weddings also tend to take on that kind of, any movies often celebrate big occasions, if they're done well, do take on that kind of patina of classic, don't they?
They do. They can. I mean, I'll be very honest. I was not, you know, the reason I chose a wedding setting was because I knew that wedding movies were profitable, and there hadn't been a black wedding movie to date.
And so, then after that, there was this whole kind of subgenre of black wedding movies.
Exactly. So, you know, I wanted to make, you know, I said I wanted to make a movie, make something commercial so that I could start my career. So that it was very calculated with you know, the idea of bringing some friends back together who were all different, but, you know, has kind of a commonality, that, you know, going to college together and putting them in a wedding setting. So, you know, with this one, I knew that you know, we'd have to have, you know, Christmas. And fortunately, you know, football falls around Christmas time, too. So, you know, it's a great event for Lance to be breaking a record at the end of his long career. And I know, look, 15 years later, he's been a pro a long time. It's very rare for a running back to be...
who can still walk, let alone...
Exactly, and still remember his name. But, you know, there are a few examples, and I can note them. You know, Curtis Martin being one of them. And Walter Payton was another one that's the test of time. You know, Jim Brown and Barry Sanders, they didn't, they stopped before they, you know, they could have gone further, but they said, I've had enough. So, I wanted to just make sure that we had an event to come to. And I thought, okay, a weekend or an extended weekend around Christmas time.
It also gives you a way to sort of do that thing which you've done in the previous Best Man film, which is sort of come up with a tribal event that separates the men from the women.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, give you know, the men that chance to, you know, to be men and talk about manly things, quote unquote, and give the women that same opportunity. I think that, you know, it's kind of akin to the card table scene in the first Best Man, which was much more male centered. But I wanted to, like, you know, split them off and give them their opportunities to be themselves, and for us, you know, as men and them as women to be the fly on the wall, so to speak.
We'll take a break. My guest who just broke my heart by bringing up Barry Sanders is Malcolm D. Lee. He's the writer-director of The Best Man Holiday, the sequel to the successful movie The Best Man. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Jump into a new mode of music discovery with the KCRW Music Mine. It's our first iPad app dedicated entirely to music exploration. The Music Mind brings you an interactive experience with a constantly evolving galaxy of audio, video, and photos. Discover by artist, by DJ, or by song, and easily share the music you love with friends. The KCRW Music Mind. Dig into it on your iPad. More info at kcrw.com.
Welcome back. My guest, who's part-time percussionist, based on what he's doing on the table in the first half of the show, is writer Malcolm D. Lee. His newest film is The Best Man Holiday, the sequel to 1999's The Best Man. And you must have been really pleased by the box office results of the movie the first weekend.
It was fantastic. I had a number in my head, and I thought, you know, let us be, and I didn't really say it to too many people, because it got to the point where, you know, you predict box office and it never, you know, comes out the way you think it's going to. And I thought, you know, if we could be north of 25, we'd be in good shape. And I thought we could achieve that. But you just never know. And then when I started hearing, you know, on Friday, on the 15th, that there were sold out shows at 10 o'clock in the morning, that people were taking the day off to see the movie, I was like, they really took, you know, Best Man Holiday as a holiday. So I was saying, oh, this is great. But, you know, of course, you hear, you know, isolated things here and there, but you're like, and you're like, well, maybe that was just one theater or whatever. It was in North Carolina, and there was one theater in New Jersey I heard about. And then in the afternoon, when I started talking to the studio, they were like, well, you know, we're headed for a good weekend. We might even beat Thor. And then, like, you know, the headlines started coming out from Hollywood Reporter and The Wrap and Deadline Hollywood. And I was like, wow, this is amazing that we could, you know, do, you know, north of 35. So, you know, obviously things came back down to earth, and we made 30. And it was great to be in the conversation and to be a, you know, part of the news story, you know, that, like, yes, Thor was number one, but we were the story. And that was incredible.
And yeah, there was a point where you were outpacing Thor.
That's right.
And you know, well, then thank God your movie wasn't called The Dark World, or else we wouldn't be really upset with you. But
but they treated it as a dark world. A lot of people did treat it as a dark world.
Well, that's,
like, they can't see it.
That's still the case, though, isn't it? I mean, since I've known you and we've had this talk about how black film success is considered to be a fluke. It's the equivalent of finding a winning lottery ticket on the street. It will never happen. Lightning is more likely to strike than a black movie being a success. And you've made two that approve this.
Yeah. It's funny. The whole notion of black movie also. It's like, I know I'm a black filmmaker, I embrace that. But what is a black movie anyway? Like, what genre is black movie?
Well, that's the sad thing about it is that, you know, there is romantic comedy, there's action melodrama, and then there are black movies.
Yeah. How do you categorize a black movie? What are the tropes of a black movie?
Let me ask you, when you deal with a studio, I'm sure they use that turn of phrase, don't they?
You know what? They never said that to me. I've dealt with Universal primarily, and, right. You know, Fox is another story, but, you know, we'll talk about that. Anyway, we can do that off the air.
No roll bounce conversation.
Oh, man. Goodness. Let's not go there. So as far as, like, you know, they talk about, you know, it being a niche movie, but they also talk about how, especially when they saw the movie and they were just like, wow, we can help get this movie crossed over. You know, this movie can appeal to a wide audience, i.e. a white audience. And, you know, look, it's such a struggle that, you know, I think all filmmakers have is finding, you know, that audience that you know, the movie will speak to. I know that the people who saw the first Best Man love this movie, love The Best Man Holiday. They absolutely are invested in the characters from beginning to end. And I know that people who are not black, who have seen the movie, love the movie as well.
I have to tell you, because the opening sequence, when you make a reprise from the first film, people were applauding and cheering in the theater when I saw it.
Oh, that's awesome.
So that there was, and I talked to a few people after, because I wanted to ask about this, and
yeah,
some of the white people who were like in their 30s said, you know what, I saw this movie on television, I ended up buying the DVD, and they said, I wasn't going to let it pass me by this time, which I found to be a really fascinating thing.
That's great. Now, I mean, I haven't heard too many stories like that. I play basketball with a bunch of guys on Saturdays, and they're like, oh, great, you know, great success for the movie. I said, have you seen it yet? And they're like, no. Like, come on, man. You're supposed to be on my side. But anyway, you know, I love hearing that people outside of the target, you know,
demographic
come and see the movie and give it a chance, and despite what, you know, some critics have said about the movie. I mean, you know,
like what?
Oh, there have been critics who are, you know, calling it, you know, melodramatic and pure drivel. I heard from one critic that it deserved a better script than this, and yada, yada, yada. It was just, it's too much crammed in into the last half an hour.
First of all, I talked with you about this before. I told you the people who didn't like the first one were going to use this as a way to go talk about how good the first one was.
That, you know what? That's exactly right. You know what? Because those same people were saying, you know, they were complaining about the first movie. It's amazing. It's really amazing. But, you know, I have to learn to not listen to critics. I just have to just not read the reviews, you know. But it's tough. You know, you're an artist. You want validation from people who are supposed to be in those positions that say we are the gatekeepers of what is supposed to be good and not good, you know. So it was the same thing with my professors at NYU. Not everybody liked my stuff.
Really?
Oh yeah. Are you kidding me? Oh, plenty.
What kind of things were they saying?
Well, there was one film that I made. It was a short, you know, called Morningside Prep. It was about, you know, these two black kids who were in a predominantly white prep school. One was a conformist, the other was a rebel. And certainly the white characters in there were archetypal, and the black characters were fuller. But it was a 25-minute short. So how much could I do?
Right.
And they were like, wow, this, you know, your white characters are there for jokes, and you know, this has no validation, and none. I'm just like, you don't know my experience, and you don't come from where I come from. So you should just, you know, take a step back and maybe, you know, take a minute to say, well, maybe this is not my experience. Maybe I can't relate, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the film is invalid.
But you must have imagined what it would have been like had you done the opposite, where you made the white characters fuller and the black characters jokes, and they would have probably gone along with it.
Are you kidding me? That happens all the time in all kinds of movies. Nobody says nobody says boo about, you know, black characters being marginalized in mainstream fare, from the Judd Apatow movies to you know, the Hangover movies to the Vince Vaughn movies. It's like a black character's in there, they're there for a joke, or they're there and they're there to you know, be like the slick guy, or to be the ghetto girl or whatever. And it's like nobody says anything, and that infuriates me when we jump on each other, meaning other like black filmgoers jump on black filmmakers to change that image. Don't do that. And they don't say anything about, you know, the mainstream movies, and nobody jumps on them about that, and nobody recognizes that. So I think we got to, like, you know, kind of change our tune with some of that stuff.
My guest who's finally become the Malcolm D. Lee I know after being running for office in the first half of the show is the writer-director of The Best Man.
Back in your cage.
No, don't use cage on a black person on this show. It's The Treatment, his new movie, The Best Man Holidays, in theaters now. But because when you brought up Roll Bounce, because I was going to, and I'm glad you did, because you gave me the in on that. Because my feeling about Roll Bounce is this part of a continuum. I mean, the characters in that movie could have grown up to be the characters in The Best Man.
Sure, absolutely.
And that movie got a treatment like it was basically like Johnson Family Vacation or something. I mean, I felt like that was a promotional campaign that didn't understand the nuance of what you were trying to put across and just sort of said, hey, this is a black movie. If you're talking about a black movie, that was a movie that was sold as if it were a black movie.
Yeah, and if it was even sold at all. I mean, like, it got to the point where the studio, they were very excited about the movie. Don't get me wrong. They were very excited about the movie, but there was too much time to try to promote it. They had an opportunity to just come out in the summertime, which they should have done.
Yes.
And they said, just bit the bullet and said, we're just going to spend the money to put it out in the summertime, not wait until the fall, which is, you know, it's a summer movie, A.
It's set in the summer.
And exactly. It's set in the summer in a roller rink in the 70s. And how do you release a movie like that, you know, in the fall when the kids are supposed to be in watching, you know, the movie, you know, in the summertime? So that was one big mistake. Then the other mistake was they just said, once they could not cross it over, meaning they could not get white people to come see the movie, they just said, forget it. We're not going to promote it to anybody. This is a $7 million investment for us. So that's it. And we will have no presence on the street. No, there's nothing. We'll make what we'll make, and it'll be fine. And, you know, that was a very big disappointment for me because they were saying to me, this was going to be the first, you know, Fox Searchlight $100 million movie. I was like, wow. Because that's the kind of high hopes they had for it. But, you know, they couldn't cross it over. So I said, well, okay, if you can't cross over, at least go to your core audience and try to get them to come. But they didn't do it. They just let it drop. It was very disappointing.
Well, it's interesting, too, because you've got that thing that when people talk about movies like Fast Times at Ridgemont High or American Graffiti, you talk about, well, the success of those casts have gone on to. And you had a case in the Best Man where you had a bunch of actors you chose on the verge of fame who have all gone on to big careers. Was it tough to get them all back?
It wasn't really, you know. Oddly enough, you know, I think And I think there's a reason for that. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. A, I think that they all really loved the first movie and the experience from it and what it did for their careers. And what, and not just that, but what it, how it made others in their lives feel. I called them all up late 2010. I said, let's get together for dinner. And I have an idea for a sequel. And I had been seeing them over the years, you know. And I'd see, you know, individually, I'd say, oh, yeah, I'm thinking about doing a sequel. And they all say, oh, okay, you know. But I said, now I'm serious. Here's a pitch. And if we think this is worth doing, let's do it. I'll pursue it. If not, then at least we've gotten back together. We've all gotten back in the same room and we've all caught up. And when we got together, before I pitched a word, there was just laughter and sharing of stories and an instant chemistry that just fell back in, you know. So I knew that if we were able to, if they liked the idea, that we'd be able to, if we ever got to a set, we'd be able to make a good movie. So I pitched them the idea and they would have said, we're in, we're totally in, and went to the studio and that was that. Now, I think also one of the reasons was nobody had been doing like stellar, you know, hadn't been working steadily, you know, I mean, except for Tay. I mean, Tay was in movies and so was Terrence. I'm sorry, Tay was in a television show and Terrence was Terrence and Regina were both doing
Law and Order LA.
And so, you know, and as of course, there was this big, you know, lull where the studio said from about 2008 to about 2011, studio said, we're not making black movies anymore, so-called black movies anymore. They don't work. Nobody wants to see them. Black people don't want to see them. Nobody wants to see them. So forget it. We're not going to. So again, all my cast was like, we're looking for work too. So, I mean, I think that was part of it. And I told them then, though, I said, even besides all that, I said, and same goes for me. I mean, I was struggling to try to figure out, what am I going to do? What's going to be my next project? And everybody was talking about what's your brand and what's the, you know, branding, and this is your brand and da 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 da. Like, so I was like, my brand is Best Man. Anybody that knows me as a director knows me. I did the Best Man. So maybe now is the time that you go ahead and try to do the sequel. And in fact, there were lots of, you know, different ideas from the studio because, again, they were a little bit nervous about this version of the movie. We actually had to do a reading for the studio to get them
You told me about it.
It wasn't that it was incredulous. I was just kind of like, this is what we have to do. This is how people have to be shown. Because especially in this day and age where it's just everyone's nervous about their own jobs and they're nervous about what to put out there and how much money they can invest in certain things, they have to be sure about it, as sure as they can, because every movie is a risk. Not just the black movies. Every movie is a risk. So, you know, we did it. It was funny because it was in January of 2012. And, you know, I was meeting with one of the executives and they were like, well, they had a whole sheet of like which ways we could possibly go. And I was like, I am not doing that. And I was ranting and raving. And then the president of the studio, Donna Langley, came in and she's like, well, let's talk about this. And, you know, we don't have to throw out the baby with the bathwater. I said, Donna, before we do any of this stuff, let me do a reading with the cast. She's like, oh, I love readings. Let's do it. So we did, and again, after that reading, that read through, they were on board, and they understood what the movie was.
Well, we're out of time. I can't thank you enough. I guess you'll be back here for the sequel, which you clearly plant the seed for at the end of this movie, and I guess there's already been a go ahead for the sequel. Right?
Well, we will write a script for sure. You know, I have an idea, and the goal of this one is to make it. I can't top it. I can't top the number two. What I can do is make it the funniest of them all.
So this one will be a comedy.
Straight comedy.
Well, for those who didn't laugh enough in the first Best Man or the Best Man Holiday, look forward to the next Best Man. Malcolm, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. My guest is Malcolm D. Lee. His newest film, go see it for the Thanksgiving holiday, is the Best Man Holiday. Our recording engineer at Carnegie Studios in New York is good to be back. It's Leszek Wojcik. The show is mixed by Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radulet. Do me a favor. Go on social media. Say how much you like the show. I'm the better man. It's the treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.